Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Matt Kelly.
And I'm Matt D'Ancona.
And this is the Two Matts podcast for the week ending Friday the 12th of January. Matt, what did we talk about this week?
We talked a lot about corporate greed in the context of both the appalling post office scandal and then we went on and talked a bit about Davos.
Yeah,
I think one of the things that we thought strongly, both of us, was that this is the post office story is only half finished, and that there need to be prosecutions. You know, people need to go to jail.
Well, that gives us a clear title for the podcast anyway. Prosecute the post office, doesn't it?
Yeah, prosecute the post office. Love it.
All right. So welcome to the Two Matts podcast for the week ending the 12th of January. Prosecute the post office.
Enjoy.
So, Matt, what are we going to talk about this week?
Well, I guess only one show in town, really, which is the post office scandal, which has been around for a long time. But yesterday at the PMQs, we're recording this on Thursday, Rishi Sunak made a brief statement about what the government now proposes to do about it. And I wonder if producer Emma could give us a quick blast of the Prime Minister on that.
Mr. Speaker, this is one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in our nation's history. People who worked hard to serve their communities had their lives and their reputations destroyed through absolutely no fault of their own. The victims must get justice and compensation. Sir Wynne Williams' inquiry is undertaking crucial work to expose what went wrong, and we've paid almost £150 million in compensation to over 2,500 victims. But today I can announce that we will introduce new primary legislation to make sure that those convicted as a result of the Horizon scandal are swiftly exonerated and compensated. We will also introduce a new upfront payment of £75,000 for the vital GLO group of postmasters. And can I thank my honourable friend, the member for Thurscombe Moulton, for all his hard work on this issue. He will set out more details to the House shortly. We will make sure that the truth comes to light, we right the wrongs of the past, and the victims get the justice they deserve.
So one of the greatest miscarriages in British legal history, Sunak says.
Which it certainly is. And so the government is taking this extraordinary step of primary legislation to exonerate the sub-paymasters who were wrongly convicted or charged or accused in this case. It's worth mentioning that only 93 of the 900 convictions have been quashed. So they're going to be exonerated in this bill, and there's going to be a further upfront £75,000 for the 555 who were involved in the 2019 class action. And we should say that this is all really in response to a television programme, which within 9 days of the first broadcast on ITV of this programme drama, excellent drama, four-part drama, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office. So it was primary legislation and the announcement that there was going to be an independent panel on the compensations involving the retired High Court Judge Sir Gary Higginbotham, and an astonishing urgency of action. I've never seen anything like it. And in fact, the inquiry under Sir Wynne Williams is carrying on today on Thursday. So I don't know what your initial reaction to this is, Matt, but I think it's kind of, for me, it's, I'm trying to take, as we try and do on the podcast, is to take as big a step back as I can to start with. And my first reflection is, I'm afraid that this is further evidence that we're not in good shape, because whilst I'm really, really glad that this is happening, because I think these people have waited too long for justice, and it's right that urgent action is being taken. Obviously, this is not what Parliament is for. Parliament is not for overturning court decisions any more than it's for saying that Rwanda is a safe place. That's not the role of Parliament. And it's poor that it's taken an ITV drama starring Toby Jones and an act of Parliament to deliver what I think most people would say is basic justice to people who are horribly wronged.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. The thing I would say which strikes me as remarkable is that how much of a story of its of these particular times this is, and
absolutely
that you wouldn't get this reaction if we weren't dealing with politics being in an absolute state of chaos. And it's a symptom of a chaotic, rudderless Parliament grasping and looking for a solution to something that's become a public storm. And I couldn't help think back to the Hillsborough disaster.
Yes.
And the way that played out. I mean, obviously, it's totally different because there was, you know, you weren't talking about people being prosecuted or members of the, you know, innocent people being prosecuted, but certainly lots of people being maligned for decades. And also the similarity of there being a very compelling docudrama about Hillsborough, which captured attention and gave the cause momentum. But again, there was nothing like the urgency. Even then, there was nothing like the urgency we've seen now.
No.
And it unsettles me a little bit that you know, one of the principles of our society is that there is a distinction between the judiciary and the legislation. And this
100%.
This has now collided, and the legislation, through political panic, I think, has overridden our judicial norms. And even though I think it's led to a proper result, I find it deeply, deeply troubling that we've arrived at this point.
I couldn't agree more. I am, as you know, a rule of law stick in the mud, you know, old school on that. And so I'm squeamish about the means that have been used, though I'm delighted by the result. Yeah. I think throughout all this, it's been interesting listening to ministers try desperately to defend due process, saying wait for the results of Sir Wynne Williams' statutory inquiry into all this. And what's interesting about some of the feedback, not least from the aggrieved sub-postmasters, is that they don't trust due process anymore. And a lot of them, one of the reasons that I think the government ended up with this solution was that so many sub-postmasters were no longer willing to come forward because they just don't trust the normal procedures. And that's a very worrying thing. And I think, again, to take it one concentric circle further out, there was a very interesting interview on Newsnight with Gwyneth Hughes, the writer of the series, the ITV series. And she put a finger on it to me, which is she said, everyone feels unheard. And I think that is the heart of the matter, is that, you know, let's look at what this is all about. It's about sub-postmasters who are often what clergymen used to be to communities. They're quiet, law-abiding citizens. They're not as amplified as organised labour or those in, you know, notable protected categories. They're what would be called in the US the forgotten middle. And they're disaggregated. They exist in isolation. And one of the saddest aspects of the whole story was the way that when they were phoning up to find out why it was that this Horizon software that was being used as basically an electronic cash till didn't work, they were told, you're the only one this is affected. So there was this kind of constant attempt to isolate these people. And I think that that sense has played into the whole kind of narrative that we've discussed on the podcast, Matt, about, you know, for want of a better phrase, broken Britain, you know, waiting lists, the Rock concrete scandal, Windrush, the New Europeans battle with Michel Moan and the pandemic scandals. And this sense that how run down and decrepit and jerry-rigged and dilapidated post-Brexit nation, our post-Brexit nation has become.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly depressing that the week began before this really sort of took flight with Rishi Sunak in his beginning of the year interview on Laura Koonsberg on the BBC calling for tax cuts.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is clear evidence, this, that we have a very badly underfunded court system, that we're contracting out on the cheap. And so you hear Sunak saying what we need is tax cuts and launching an attack on what he calls the permanent state, which is his version of the deep state. And actually, you know, this is not the problem. The problem is that government is in its desperation to outsource and its veneration for private sector collaborations has presided over, and includes all parties, over an absolutely monstrous miscarriage of justice involving people, you know, four of whom took their own lives. I think more than 230 went to jail.
Yeah.
You know, these are lives that have been ruined.
Horrific.
They don't have time on their side, these people.
Horrific. And one of the aspects that's intrigued me is the corporate culture within Post Office that allowed this to go on for literally two decades. You know, this software was installed in 1999, and almost immediately there were a procession of complaints about irregularities and stuff like this. And then I think Alan Bates threw in the towel in 2003. So we're literally talking 20 years ago that this...
Yes.
And the fact that we can talk about Paul Levenels later, but, you know, Adam Crozier was chief executive of the Post Office for a long time. His name has been largely absent from damnation. Maybe that'll change. But there's clearly... I was trying to get my head inside what was going on around the boardroom and in the senior executive management meetings at the Post Office when these complaints came in. And I've got a theory, and I might be wrong, but my theory is this, because I've seen it happen, where you have communities of people, constituencies of people who are at a distance and are seen by management of big corporations as somehow menial and lesser, right? And I'll bet you that the senior management of the Post Office looked at sub-postmasters with a degree of disdain and were saying, firstly, well, the idiots can't make it work, or they've just made it. Or, and I'll bet you this was said openly, well, they've all got their fingers in the till anyway. You know, I'll bet you that was the kind of mindset of senior management around the board tables of the Post Office. And that will have gone on for 20 years where they have... they've incriminated a group of people with no real evidence. Of course, every organisation's got people who act badly.
I bet you, though, they're proportionately a more honest, decent bunch than many professions. Because the kind of demographic from which they're drawn, you know?
Yeah, I'd back that completely. But I'll bet you that there was an arrogance and a disdain at the top of the Post Office when they were talking about sub-postmasters as a group of people. And that this has led to the kind of attitude towards people that is dehumanizing. You know, they've dehumanized them. And this is where what's blown up this week is the humanity of it. So you've had
absolutely.
A corporation that dehumanized a group of people and said, well, they've all got their fingers in the till. They're all idiots. They're all they're all chancing. And so every time it came up, the assumption was, oh, they're bent. You know, it's not the software, they're bent. And what's happened this week is the human stories have come to the fore, which are inarguable. And honestly, anybody who's listened to some of these tales, I mean, there've been people crying on the Today programme as they've told how their lives have been ruined. And it would take a bloody heart of stone not to cry along with them. It's absolutely appalling.
It's heartbreaking.
Well, so just Matt, just to close that point, was there were a lot of headlines this morning on the national newspapers saying justice at last and all of this business.
Yes.
Well, I half agree. Justice will be when the people who allowed this to carry on don't just hand back CBEs and get pulled up before public inquiry.
Oh, yeah.
But are prosecuted for absolute criminal behaviour.
This is absolutely essential. Look, the other shoe has yet to drop, okay? So what we're looking at now is the compensation, or as the sub-postmasters prefer, financial redress, for what they rightly regard as the embezzlement by the post office to the tune of many millions of their money. I think you also saw a really ugly convergence going on here. So the post office was established in 1660. It's one of the great historic institutions of this country, and it attracts, or used to attract, huge loyalty, a sense that the universal service was part of what bound us together as a country, and so on. And sub-postmasters were, as I said earlier, you know, they were figures of some standing in their local communities in a quiet way. So you have that. But on the other hand, you also have the ethos and culture of the private sector coming into it. So on the one hand, the post office historically had this power, anomalous power, of private prosecution, that it could be both the prosecutor and the aggrieved party, which is dubious. And Alex Chalk, the justice secretary and shadow chancellor, is now looking into private prosecutions, and not before time. But also there was this power of there were the investigators who had these legal powers being offered bonuses to reach a certain number of convictions or charges, which is a grotesque way of going about natural justice. You know, you had post office investigators going around with quotas and personal incentives to nail as many of these often lonely, by no means legally literate people to the wall, and they got what they wanted. So there's a combination of massive institutional sort of prestige in the post office, but the most ruthless form of competitive private sector culture converging, and that was a disgraceful thing to happen. And I think one of the things we can probably, I remember when PMQs was going on yesterday, Matt, and on Wednesday, and we were WhatsApping each other, and it was, we both noticed that Keir Starmer didn't go on the post office. He went on small boats and migration. And this is noticeable, because if ever there was a murder on the Orient Express politically, this is it. I mean, it was fascinating, because 30p Lee, our great, one of our podcast heroes, stood up and tried to goad Sunak into calling for Ed Davey's resignation as Lib Dem leader, on the grounds that Ed Davey had been postal affairs minister between 2010 and 2012. And it's fair to say that Ed Davey seems to have been at best incurious about the scandal. But it was also notable that Starmer, Sunak didn't take the bait on calling for Davey to stand down, and Starmer didn't press Sunak at all. And I think the reason for this is that everyone has a measure of culpability in this. You know, this was ordered by John Major's government. It was implemented by Tony Blair's government. Even though in 1998, Harriet Harman, who was then the Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, wrote to Blair and told him there was a serious risk that the project would not deliver its objectives. Then you go to Post Office Minister under Gordon Brown, Pat McFadden, Keir Starmer's election chief, and then any number of Conservatives responsible to the present day. So everyone has their dabs on this.
Yeah,
totally. And it's, you know, there have been some very, I don't know what you think, but there have been some very lame attempts overnight. Again, we're recording this on Thursday, to nail Keir Starmer when he was Director of Prosecutions at the CPS, Public Prosecutions, and say, actually, you know, he knew all about this. It's quite clear that he didn't. And the number of prosecutions that were actually coming across his desk appeared to have been zero or very few. So, you know, this is not unusually, it's not a party political issue. I would say, however, there's always a however, isn't there? When you look at Fujitsu, the company that is responsible for Horizon, the system under question, the software system under question, It has a market cap of more than $27 billion. And the government of this country, in spite of everything that's been revealed about the system since 2009, when Computer Weekly really got into it, remains Fujitsu's biggest US customer, accounting for about 190 of the contracts. And unbelievably, and I still can't get my head around this, in November last year, Fujitsu was handed a 36 million quid extension to keep Horizon running until at least 2025. And the FT did a great report this week saying that Fujitsu was involved in 3.6 billion pounds of contracts while Sunak was Chancellor of PM. I'll repeat that, 3.6 billion pounds of contracts. Now, how can that be right? You know, the speed of accountability, for the speed of action, of prosecution against the sub-postmasters was, you know, they didn't hang around. But Fujitsu is multinational, is still benefiting from huge contracts.
Well, it's Fujitsu. It's Fujitsu who will have to, who also run the criminal records database, and who will be taking the sub postmaster's name off the criminal records database for the mistake that they made putting them on the criminal records database. So the amount of reliance on this company is just beyond belief.
I'm afraid I've gone a bit medieval, as they say in Pulp Fiction, on all this now. I think it's incredibly important, because we've talked a bit about building trust in the system again. And I think that somehow some of the key culprits in the system have to go to jail. And I mean jail. We've talked about Paula Bunnells, who was the CEO of the post office between 2012 and 2019. She handed back her CBE this week. So what, right? That's a wrinkle in the story. What about the 2.2 million quid she took in bonuses, right? So let's claw back some of the bonuses from some of the people who took money whilst this was going on. But also, you know, it's time for imaginative prosecutions of people, because you cannot have faceless corporations like Fujitsu taking huge sums of taxpayers' money, leading to the ruination of hundreds of people's lives, quite wrongly, and then not being accountable or paying fines. I mean, it's all well and good, and I'm glad ministers are now talking about how Fujitsu should cough up for the compensation. But we all know that big corporations like Fujitsu have very, very extensive insurance plans that enable them to pay out what are for them, you know, lunch money sums, right? I want to see people behind bars. And I really do think this is important. And I know that sounds Old Testament, but actually, one of the problems we got to where we are now, where trust is in the gutter,
yeah,
is 2008, 2009, there was the financial crisis, which led to huge numbers of job losses, huge numbers of home losses, disaster for people with their savings, their pensions, and practically no bankers went to jail. It is time for these people to do the perp walk and go behind bars.
Couldn't agree more. And I'll take it, well, maybe it's a step further, maybe it isn't, but let me outline a process in which, say, you could say, as you know, obviously the most acute part of this story, those four poor people who killed themselves because their lives had been ruined by these erroneous prosecutions. Well, if you could draw a direct link between somebody in a boardroom saying, I don't care, our reputation's more important than these sub-postmasters, hang them out to dry, carry on with the prosecutions. And I think you've got a case there where you should be prosecuting for manslaughter.
Yes, I agree.
You've driven someone to the grave through your negligence and greed, then there has to be an ultimate penalty. And by the way, the idea that suggesting these people should go to jail is some sort of Old Testament solution. Well, they didn't hesitate when they were sending sub-postmasters to jail. You know,
no, quite right.
And in fact, There was the poor woman who featured highly. It's Jo, isn't it? Who featured in the drama.
Jo Hamilton,
who later uncovered that there was a document from the post office saying that there were no evidence of theft at all. No evidence of theft at all. It was just an inexplicable shortfall, except for the fact that the computers didn't work. And they sent her to jail, you know?
And they knew as far back as 1998-9 that the system was not working properly.
Yeah.
And they lied. And this is, I think, is the most, perhaps the most wicked, and I use that word advisedly, wicked, aspect of the way they were, the sub-postmasters were handled. That they said, oh, no, no one has access to your Horizon system. That was a lie. That was a straightforward, let's call it what it was. It was a lie. And they, you know, post office lied to Parliament, lied in the courts, lied everywhere. We now know that they had all sorts of means of access to the Horizon systems of branches. And that, to me, is a shocking act of fraud, of embezzlement. Because these people had to sell their houses, cash in their pensions, give up their life savings, go to jail. You know, some of them suffered from appalling mental health problems, and some of them died, and some of them have died of natural causes. Because, of course, what corporations have on their side, apart from huge resources, is time. They know how to lawyer up and kick the can down the road. And we're talking about people who, you know, have waited. It was 25 years already since this really became an issue, and you know, people are still waiting for justice. 25 years in a lifetime is an enormous thing.
I'd love to know the people who were complicit in this scandal, in this cover-up. Where are they all now? You know, because they're not all still at the post office. They'll be sitting in big jobs somewhere or big consultancy fees somewhere. And on their CV, well, maybe they're ripping it off LinkedIn right now as we speak, but somewhere on their CV will be the important the important role they played in installing Horizon at the post office.
Absolutely.
You know, punish them.
100%. And I think that, I mean, there are two points that spring to mind. One is that Wynne Williams' report on this may actually drop into a new government's in tray, because it's promised by the end of the year. And by then, we might have a Labour government. So this could be a challenge facing Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Who knows? Yeah. I mean, one hopes the inquiry delivers before then. But the other thing I think, and it's again, it's a sort of broader point, is since the Thatcher era and then through New Labour and to the present day, there's been a sort of reverence for the private sector. Now, I've got nothing against the private sector per se, but there's been this idea that somehow business does government better than government. So it's completely legitimate to slag off Whitehall, to slag off town halls, to slag off public servants. But if you talk about big business, there's a kind of hush and a kind of, you know, reverence about it. And we saw this to the max in the pandemic, where let's take Test and Trace, okay, which was, you had Sir Paul Nurse of the Francis Crick Institute saying, look, we have capacity in labs and universities which are deserted at the moment to really get up and running on Test and Trace. And he called it, ironically, given what happened with small boats, he called it the Little Boats Initiative, a reference to the Dunkirk rescue. And instead, Matt Hancock went with Deloitte and Serco. Now, maybe I'm stupid, but I'm not aware of Deloitte and Serco having a particularly distinguished record in healthcare and you know, management of complex, you know, health issues. But so sort of mesmerized our ministers by the idea that business is always good. You know, and we've seen this before. We saw this, the scandal of disability assessments carried out by ATOS, the Capita scandal in 2015, G4S unable to provide security in the Olympics in 2012, Carillion, You remember them? Construction and other services went into liquidation in 2018. Time and time again.
Well, we've seen it. We've seen it most recently with Michelle Moan, Doug Barrowman and PPE MedPro, you know, where...
Exactly.
A simple question. Have you ever sourced PPE before in your lives? The answer, no. Might have just, you know, halted that in its tracks. Did it? Nah.
And there's a sort of very lazy idiom attached to this that, you know, people who are involved in business are all about enterprise and competition and action and urgency, and these are the things that are lacking from our terrible establishment state. And there are moments where contracting out can be helpful, but the idea that the default position should be whenever there's a task facing government it should be contracted out is unbelievably dodgy. And we've known this for 30 years that the procurement processes in this country are dodgy. They are linked far too heavily into cheapness, you know, which is called value for money, but it's doing it on the cheap.
Yeah.
And this is what you get. And what you get is Fujitsu not ready to do what it was called ICL, I think, at the beginning, and then took on the name of Fujitsu in 2002. By no means ready. This was absolutely bound to happen.
Yeah.
And yet, but here's the thing, is so important is it to preserve the myth that big business, that corporate groups are unimpeachable, that successive ministers were willing to take a sort of what they call an arm's length approach, right? We'll leave it to the post office and to the Royal Mail as it was. And, you know, Ed Davey said, oh, I was lied to by the post office. Well, you know, the job of a minister, especially when you're dealing with contracted out services, is to dig. You know, is the taxpayer getting value for money? Not let them do what they want. I mean, this is a cultural thing.
Just before we close down on this topic and go to the second half, I want to give a big shout out to Ian Hislop and Private Eye, and also the guys at Computer Weekly whose journalism exposed this story, which was then told brilliantly in the ITV drama. But I also want to give a negative shout out to most of Fleet Street, who've been busy on the bandwagon ever since, saying, oh, we've done 300 stories about this. Fleet Street barely put this on page one ever. And when you think about the elements of this story, that how it's not a page one scandal story from day one, I've got no idea. But Hislop and Private Eye kept battering away. So absolute kudos to those guys. And Liz Gerrard in the New European this week has got a brilliant...
Very good piece.
Brilliant forensic essay.
Very good piece.
About the negligence of Fleet Street in covering this story. So don't, listeners, have your wool pulled over your eyes by all these Fleet Street hacks coming out saying, oh, we've been banging the drum forever. They haven't.
Another name I'd like to give a shout out to is Nick Wallace, whose brilliant book, The Great Post Office Scandal in 2021. And if you haven't read it, listeners, do order a copy. It's just excellent journalism. You know, Nick Wallace is the absolute epitome of the dogged, resilient, persistent investigative journalist. And what's interesting is that pretty much everything that's in the drama is in Nick's book. And indeed, most of the key facts were known at the latest by 2019, when the main court case came out, and on the Alan Bates case. But I think that what's incredibly concerning is, obviously, I'm delighted that an ITV drama of huge quality has led to a good outcome. But it's alarming, isn't it, that we trust Toby Jones, the voice of Dobby in Harry Potter, the star of The Detectress, a familiar, you know, warm face from countless movies and dramas, more than we do politicians, and it's not a sustainable model. You know, because two historic accidents happened here. First of all, you had Alan Bates. Incredible man. Incredible, you know, preternatural stamina just to go year after year after year. And he's still, you know, I noticed that he was asked, are you celebrating the Times this morning, Thursday? And he said, you must be joking. You know, he's going to carry on till the last day. But there are very few people come along like that. I mean, one sort of slight parallel is Chris Mullin, a former Labour MP and minister who campaigned for the Birmingham Six over many, many years and against great, you know, resistance. But so you get historical accident number one, Alan Bates. If Alan Bates hadn't come along, I wonder if any of this would have happened.
Yeah.
Historical accident number two is that at New Year, you get Toby Jones, the ideal actor, to play this. And suddenly it hits a nerve. Okay, great. You know, what's not to like? But you can't base an accountable system upon that sort of historical contingency. You know, the system is meant to preclude the necessity for such individuals. You know, that's the point of the system.
There is something beautiful about a piece of art, which that series is, transcending everything else in the system, though, and overturning everything.
Yes.
Because what, again, to touch on what we were saying earlier, what Toby Jones managed to articulate, which no judge can, no politician can, and newspapers are getting worse and worse at, used to be very good at it, not so much anymore, is the humanity of it. And all you had to do was look in Toby Jones's face for 4 hours and you saw a whole universe of pain that these people had suffered for decades. It was all there.
I mean, the trouble is, as and this is not an original point, it's been made by several people this week, is that, you know, we can't rely on Toby Jones to do a documentary on Grenfell
and the blood
contamination scandal and Brexit. Yeah. And, you know, it's a fantastic happening. And by the way, a side issue, you know, it demonstrates that those who would pare down the cultural sector in this country and think that the only thing that matters is STEM subjects. And they do matter, right? They do matter. But, you know, Rishi Sunak going on about everyone having to do maths till they're 26. Fine. Okay. Yeah. But sometimes the creative sector can have a huge, palpable, consequential impact upon political life. And it has more, I think, probably. I don't know what you think, Matt, but anything since Cathy Come Home in 1966, maybe?
Yeah. No, I think so. I think probably.
Maybe The Boys from the Black Stuff in 82. Yeah.
Well, I think Boys from the Black Stuff was... Boys from the Black Stuff, from my era, was the thing that hit people like a stomach punch.
The juggernaut.
I mean, it really was incredibly powerful stuff. And I think Jimmy McGovern has taken that up admirably in the past. And now we've got this. So I think there's certainly plenty of precedent, but you're right. I wouldn't want to be a victim of some injustice and have to wait around for ITV to decide to commission a drama before my name is cleared.
No, because the other thing is that, you know, I mean, actually, you know, anyone who's been involved in the commissioning process, and I have obliquely, knows how arbitrary it can be. Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of project that, had it not had someone of Toby Jones's stature attached to it, might well just have you know, been a thanks but no thanks, and we wouldn't be here.
Thank God for Toby Jones. That's been a long but I hope interesting first half to the podcast, and we're going to come back later in a few minutes after a short break with some thoughts about the faceless masters of the universe, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
See you in a moment. Thank you for listening to The Two Mats. And if you like the kind of conversations we have here, there are loads more to be had in print and online at The New European. And I have got a very special offer for all listeners of The Two Mats. We are giving away copies of Alistair Campbell's Diaries 2023, which is a book we're publishing this month. It's fantastic diary full of everything that's happened, all the people he's met, and anybody who's a fan of Alistair Campbell's diaries over the years know how brilliantly he turns them out. He is very much a latter-day Samuel Pepys.
He really is.
He is. So you can get a free copy of Alistair Campbell's diaries, 2023, worth £20, when you subscribe to The New European from as little as £1 a week. Or if you like getting the newspaper delivered to your door every single week, you can have that for just another pound a week. And that's a 75% saving on the price you'll pay at the newsagents. To get this great offer, go to www.theneweuropean.co.uk/2mats.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, Matt, Davos. That name, that sounds like a Doctor
Davos.
Monster. Yeah, it sounds like...
It does, yes, yes.
The creatures from the planet Davos. Tell you're writing about them this week in The New European.
Yes, yes, the present issue of The New European has a column indeed, by me on this important subject.
I should know that, shouldn't
I? Davos, no, well, you know, you've got a lot on. You've got a lot on. Look, Davos has always been a bugbear of mine, and it became enormously so after the populist uprisings of 2016. For those who don't know, and I hope lots of people don't know about it, because it's something that it's healthy not to know about. But Davos is the annual summit in the Swiss Alpine town of Davos in the Alps. And it's this year, it's between January the 15th and 19th, so next week. And about 3,000 people of various levels of seniority from the corporate, governmental, NGO, supranational organization worlds, and a huge cohort of salivating client journalists descend upon Davos. And why is this a bad thing? Well, it's a bad thing for several reasons, because there's a sort of massive self-aggrandizing culture. You know, I called it in the column institutionalized humble brag. And what they do at Davos is this year's theme is rebuilding trust. And I note that in 2003 it was building trust, so I'm not quite sure what the difference is. And there's a sort of bland word salad that the organisers use in their annual slogan, and it always involves words like leadership, cooperation, sustaining, responsibility, tough choices, shared norms, stakeholding. I mean, it's just banal, vacuous language. And the point of it is to suggest urgency of action in the most vapid possible slogans you can come up with. Now, why does this matter? It matters because the whole outfit is really a massive pay-to-play exercise where corporates pay $600,000 a year and individuals pay anything from $28,000 and more. They arrive there in their private jets. They hold forth sanctimoniously about sustainability and climate change, and then they head off. And there's something about it that is, I think, particularly now. I mean, we talked last week in the podcast about the dangers of 2024, prime amongst which is the possibility of Trump's re-election. And what Davos does is it's an annual celebration of the global economic and financial journalistic and NGO and international organization corporate complacency in the face of terrible, terrible things. What do they believe? Well, what they believe is they're not to blame. Okay, so their sort of binding principle, I call it karaoke morality, right? Is that
brilliant phrase.
They, rather than governments or regulators, are better at deciding how money is distributed and controlled. Philanthropy is better than taxation. I mean, the minute you think about that, it's absurd. Organized labor is terrible. And anyone who disagrees with them is a crazed Luddite. And so you have that sort of underpinning series of principles. But you also have this astonishing self-congratulation. So my favorite one was in 2021 when the summit was held online. Mark Benioff, who's the billionaire co-founder of the software giant Salesforce, said in the pandemic, as a quote, it was the CEOs in many, many cases all over the world who were the heroes. It's unbelievable. I mean, given how many health workers had died, how many people who weren't health workers had died, the idea that it was chief executives who were the real heroes, not to mention the fact that in that past year, the wealth of billionaires worldwide had risen by, wait for it, $3.9 trillion, while more than 500 million had gone into poverty. So you have that. Then you think, well, okay, how have they responded to the most, you know, pressing problem of our time, populism? And the answer is they haven't responded at all. They say, we're very worried about authoritarianism and populism and the forces that give rise to it. But I was looking at the guest list for 2024 next week, and there on the list is the Chinese second in command, Li Qiang, and, wouldn't you know, Javier Milei, the recently elected far-right, populist, crazy, El Loco president of Argentina. Now, what's he doing there? You know, if you're serious at Davos about doing something about populism, but they've had Trump, they've had Bolsonaro, they've had Xi Jinping, they are completely open to the very people whom they claim to oppose. And the key is, and this is what I find sickening about the whole thing, you only have to hear people who are going there talk about why they're going there. They claim they're going there because they want to improve the state of the world. But what they're really going there to do is reassure one another that whatever happens, however bad it gets, they'll be okay.
This is at the core of it. And what I find sickening, and we fall through it all the time, the whole global economy is built on this premise, is that they go there and present themselves as radicals and revolutionaries, and they're not. The only thing they're interested in is the preservation of the status quo, because they're in the room. And the worst thing that can happen to them is one year they're not in the room anymore. But the whole foundation, the charade they play is that they go to these things and they're going to talk about recreating a better world. They're not, all they're doing is reaffirming the same broken structures that are driving the world further and further into trouble. And I was listening to a brilliant podcast. I think I might have mentioned it in the past. It's called Philosophize This. Brilliant podcast by a guy called Stephen West. And this week's he's talking about anarchy theory. But he mentions a philosopher. I can't remember the guy's name. But it was honestly one of those moments where you sort of think, this is it, absolutely right, where everything is just about the preservation of our addiction to consumption, you know, and everything.
Yeah.
So, and he makes the example of, so say you've got a car factory that's making cars with internal combustion engines, and suddenly the management decide it's going to make solar panels in that factory now. And the point is, it's not about... their motivation is not about saving the planet. Their motivation is just about keeping on exploiting loads of people, keeping on consumption levels high, keep on with the same status quo that we've been stuck with. And what Stephen West says is what nobody does is address the problems that are the underlying problems, like our relationship with the planet, our relationship with ourselves, the fact that our communities have got so big that the granular, to be a person, to be a man or a woman in a community of this scale is meaningless, because we've lost touch with everything. So I just think, you know, this, when these people meet in this little Swiss village, the irony is that is one community that is in touch with itself, but their aim is to defeat every other community by just maintaining the status quo in which they are at the top of the heap.
And they are committed to doing the bare minimum performatively to keep things at bay. Now, I suspect that it was Samuel P. Huntington who in 2004 first coined the phrase Davos Man, or popularized it. And I think that the age of Davos Man may be slowly drawing to a close, because it looks increasingly ridiculous. But they won't give up without a fight. And what's fascinating is how outraged they are and how piqued they are at criticisms. I mean, it really tells you a lot about them. They've enjoyed a culture of impunity for so long. And it goes back to what we were talking about in the first half about Fujitsu and the post office scandal. You know, these big corporations are not used to being held to account, partly because they haven't been. You know, they really haven't. What happened after, this goes back a long way, what happened after the end of the Cold War was that there was a silent agreement between governments and corporations that they were going to rule the world in coalition. And this was not written down anywhere, but that was the deal, that both parties of the centre-right and of the centre-left were going to cooperate to the max with huge multinational corporations to build some sort of new world order. Well, you know, here we are. The world is burning, and it hasn't worked, and yet... What you'll see next week, even though Milei is there, even though Li Kuang is there, you'll hear a great deal about how businesses are, you know, painting murals in Malawi and recycling plastic and doing lots of nice diversity schemes, which are excellent in and of themselves. And their line really is, will this do? Mm. And the answer has to be no. And that's why in the column I said the best thing that Davos could do is abolish itself, because it does have a pernicious effect, because it has this sort of bogus glamour. You know, but I think Klaus Schwab, who founded it in 1971, was very shrewd in choosing a remote alpine resort, because if this was held in New York or London or DC or Shanghai or any of these places... Yeah. It would have less glamour. You know, there's a sort of spurious glamour about going to a ski resort.
Well, people would be able to get to them as well. You know, you'd have tens of thousands of people throwing stuff at the limousines and the private jets.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, it's a lot harder to occupy Davos than it is to occupy Wall Street. It's a lot harder to get up there. But the very remoteness of it, you know, and I was hearing this week about people heading off already on private jets to Davos, and you think, what's going through your head? Look at the world. You know, we are in genuine danger of Trump becoming president again. We've seen Italians using the fascist salute in recent days. We've got Milei in Argentina, who's going to Davos mysteriously. You know, we've got Orban, back. And stronger than ever. We've got Marine Le Pen making gains in France. The AfD in Germany, everywhere we look, the direction of travel towards populist right-wingery, not everywhere. I mean, Poland is good, and hopefully we'll get a centre-left government in this country this year. But the direction of global travel is towards more populism, more nativism, more nationalism. And there are very complex reasons for this, but these guys who are going to congregate in Davos have a lot to answer for, because they are structurally complacent and they need to be called out, because, again, they have this spurious glamour that... And you know, the Bono and Will.i.am and people like that turn up, Matt Damon, and kind of schmooze, and it's all incredibly cozy. It's the world's warmest echo chamber.
It's the world's second warmest echo chamber. The warmest echo chamber, I like to think, is the Two Mats podcast. And thank you.
Well, that's it. Yeah, but we are porous. We are, you know, we are accountable. Yeah. To a maximum extent. Yeah, right. And also, not for nothing, but, you know, every podcast does have a measure of accountability, because it has listeners. You know, how is Davos accountable? It isn't. Abolish it.
On that note...
Davos delenda est.
Yes, just for clarity, folks, we're saying abolish Davos, not the Two Mats podcast. We very much enjoy...
No. We shall outlive Davos.
Perhaps Davos will do a podcast saying abolish the Two Mats.
Klaus Schwab, you know how to get in touch.
Well, listen, that's all for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Our listener numbers have gone up and up in the last few weeks, so we're really grateful for all of those new listeners.
Thank
I hope
you
you're enjoying the show. Please email in any questions for our regular Sunday morning Q&A show that we do, and also any feedback, anything you like or you don't like. We had loads of feedback about our suggestion from last week's Q&A that overseas votes for expats don't matter, and we had a lot of expats rather miffed writing in and saying, well, they do. So anyway, listen, we heard you and we listened to all those emails. Thank you for sending them in. Please send in any more too. Two Mats, that's the number 2, MATTS, at tnepublishing.com. That's Two Mats at tnepublishing.com. Thank you as ever to our great production team this week, led by Emma at Rethink Audio. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you, Emma.
And until next week,
it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from him.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.